Hi, and welcome to I Want What She Has, a show that amplifies women's voices and their stories. I am your host, Teresa Widman, and on today's show, I am playing two interviews I did of conversations that I had with two very inspiring women. The first conversation is with Keiko Sono, who is an artist by education and training, who shifted into studying permaculture and really now tries to embody permacultural principles to her entire life and to her community. And she's going to talk specifically about some art projects that she's working on to collaborate with community, as well as why she's a big proponent of universal basic income. Secondly, we are going to hear an interview that I did with Claudia Abbott Barish, who is the Restorative Justice Coordinator at the Mediation Center of Dutchess County. Claudia has really been in activism for much of her life, and she's switched gears from the form that she was engaged with to something that is embodying restorative practices as a means of activism. And so we get to understand what that means, about why she decided to make that transition. I really enjoyed my conversation with Claudia. We got to talk about a lot of things that are near and dear to my heart, that make me think and make me, I hope, become a better person, a better contributing member of the community. And so I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. So sit back and relax. Keep your hands on the steering wheel, your eyes on the road, wherever you might be, and enjoy my conversations with Keiko and Claudia. So I'm sitting down with Keiko Sono, who I was introduced to from a mutual friend, somebody who was on the show previously, Jenny Fowler, who is an amazing human. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to do so. And Jenny really thought that Keiko would make a great guest, and I had a chance to talk to Keiko, and I agree 100%. She's a very inspiring human. And I wanted to just share a little bit on her website as an introduction to her and her very broad-ranging work, I would say. Her website says, "My work has one fundamental goal: to connect us to the world, to other beings, the natural environment, or objects, in present, past, or future, in absurdity, wit, or utter beauty. I use visual media, video, and text to create events and projects that focus on connections. The process is guided by intuitive pursuit for fun and pleasure, while the planning is based on how many new connections would be made, how much the existing ones would be strengthened, and how many people or things would benefit from it." Which sounds like an ideal world to be living in. So I just want to thank you, Keiko, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's really exciting.
I wanted to start, I mean, I'll just sort of like start the story a little bit. Keiko has a very, I think, interesting story, and all of it helps to paint the picture of where she is right now. We obviously won't have time to go into all of the details, but I did want to start out really with what you were doing. I mean, you are an artist and you were doing a certain type of art. You started doing a certain type of art. And I wonder if you can just talk about how you got into that. You were doing painting, right?
That's right. So my training is in painting. I got my master's degree from NYU in painting. And back then, the practice of painting was very straightforward. Your goal was to establish your own style, and you become your own individual artist, and you establish a relationship with a gallery, go to art fairs, and cultivate relationships with your collectors, and become rich and famous.
It's everyone's dream.
That's right. And I really had no question about it. This was like in the late 80s and 90s, and the problems that we face right now were just under the surface. So they were really not on my radar in my early 20s. And I was, it seemed to me that I was on my way to being that. I had a gallery representative in Tokyo who took me to art fairs like in Berlin and Madrid. I had collectors and I had a museum show. But then as I got deeper into that world, I started to question the integrity of the system itself. Because even though it was painting, when I first started my art practice, I was still really coming from the place that art is something really sacred. Art is something that could possibly contribute to the well-being of the human beings and the world. And the more I got to know the market system, the clearer it became that the painting or artwork was a vehicle for reinforcing the system that actually created the hardship by widening the inequality. Inequality was really not that much of a talking point at that time, but you know, I was feeling it. So when I first moved up here from New York, I didn't even really think that there would be any viable artist community here. I thought that maybe there would be like kind of quaint landscape artists, and I didn't really even think that it would be my option to consider the artist community as, you know, something that would really, that I would really find meaning in. But to the contrary, I found an amazing pool of creative and energetic and really generous pool of people who kept producing art without the you know, prospect of, you know, making a lot of money or even like becoming really, you know, recognized. And yet the kind of work that I was seeing here was not only really high in quality, but really generous, you know, really, really abundant. So that's when I started thinking that the fact that these people are not really getting paid to do their work, it is not only harmful to the artists themselves, but it's also harmful to the society who's really missing out on this incredible output.
So were you still making art when you moved up here?
Yes. I had pretty much established my style, so I felt that I could be away from the New York City art market and still could produce.
What came first? Because you ended up pursuing permaculture as a lifestyle and kind of a practice. Did letting go of the art happen first, or did you find permaculture, which helped you let go of the art for a while?
It was a gradual process. I did let go of painting or studio art practice as it was over the course of maybe 3 or 4 years. After I had my museum show in Japan, I was introduced to a couple of collectors there. And my gallerist, with incredible enthusiasm, said, "Hey, Keiko, this collector, he's one of the top three collectors, and he has a state-of-the-art storage space, and your paintings are going to go in there." So I was like, okay. I mean, that was not really what I had in mind. But then, you know, I had to go to parties, and I had to talk to these people, and it just really became clear to me that it was incongruent with my original starting point of being an artist. I mean, I didn't really become an artist. You know, this you hear from many artists. You know, artists say they have no choice. They're born artists. You know, it's not like they choose to be artists. And I'm the same way. And also at the same time, after that show, there was the second election of George W. Bush. And to me, that was a shock. I was pregnant with my second child, and I started seeing the impact of climate change because I was painting outdoors. And all these things combined, I felt that I just had to make a big change. So I left my studio and I started practicing permaculture, which to me opened up a huge possibility to me. Also being a mother, you know, I was always really pressed for time, and I felt like I was always like really fragmented. The principle of permaculture, where you see every element of your life as having a function to support each other, and each element is in turn supported by multiple elements. That principle applied to life really helped me ground myself in all of this really chaos. So, for example, like, you know, recording the natural world, either in my painting or photograph, also became my personal archive of history, and also a way to, you know, connect with the environment and, you know, so forth.
So can we just stop to talk about permaculture? And because it's a word that's starting to be used more regularly, but I don't know that everyone understands it. And so what did that mean that you started to study it and you started to get into it? And I don't know. I mean, you just gave a great description of it, but I wonder if there's other ways that you would describe it to help paint a picture for people who maybe aren't familiar with it.
So permaculture is, it's really based on the land management. To simply put it, let's say you want to have chickens and vegetable gardens and maybe gray water system on your land. So you would place chicken coop on the uphill so that the, you know, the waste from chicken coop would nourish the vegetable garden, and the water, after it filters through the gray water system, would disperse into the land so that it would hydrate the land. I mean, this is just a really simplified way of describing it. And they offer a design course, which is taught by students of permaculture. The students who've finished the design course are allowed to teach the design course. So it's like a way of like dispersing knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So then what did, going through that course, how did that change your life?
I started to see my life more integrated in the community. Like the elements within my life became more integrated, and my life itself became more integrated with the larger community. And I started to see our community more integrated within the larger system of the nation and the world.
Mm-hmm. And then it, from what I understand, and I don't want to incorrectly state the timeline, but you then started to get back into your artwork through in a different way, right?
Yes, I did that as part of the community. So this is something really significant. You know, when you're painting, you think of yourself as an individual that's really separate from others. In fact, you have to establish yourself as an individual that's really different and superior to other painters. Yeah. That's how you become successful. But I've always wondered, well, is that really true? Like, where do I end and you begin? Because you're always influenced by those who came before you, and you're always constantly influenced by the world that surrounds you. So can you really say with all confidence that your work is yours and yours only? And studying permaculture really helped me break that barrier. And by going out to the community, and I started curating shows and collaborating with other like galleries and other individuals, and that became more and more apparent to me that no, it's not. I mean, that boundary is not that clear. And once you break down that boundary, you become freer.
Yeah, it's like that, you know, it's open source in a software perspective, right?
Totally.
And I'm just, as I'm hearing you talk, you know, you're describing a world that feels idyllic. You know, it just feels like if we could all live that way, how beautiful would that be? But there's such fear in letting go of that ego, you know, that individualism, and trusting in a group. And I wonder if at any point, you know, up to in your story thus far, like you were really confronted with any kind of fears.
All the time. Well, I have to say, if we didn't go into the Iraq war, if Bush was a better president, if Obama had held more people accountable after the 2008 crash, and you know, if we didn't have climate change, I think I would have been fine being an individual artist. But as such, there is such a need to make a transformational change to the way we live if we want to survive as a human species, and also, you know, the entire planet, you know, for the well-being of the entire planet. So interestingly, right now, because of all the daunting changes, all these, what you just said, the idyllic vision of the world is now becoming more of a necessity. So I think I'm seeing that there are more doors opening up for people who believe in this kind of vision.
I want to talk a little bit about the Catskill Waters project. I mean, some of the projects that you're working on right now, you and I have talked a little bit offline about how you're really beginning to kind of form relationships with people who maybe hold different opinions and different ideologies and maybe live differently or think they live differently. You know, largely working in more rural communities and more conservative communities. And so I think it's, you know, I'm like watching your life and thinking this is such a great model. And if this experiment works, then bravo, Keiko's figured it out. And we just have to all do what she's doing. But so let's talk a little bit about the Catskill Waters project and how you got involved with that and what it is.
Okay. Catskill Waters is a public outreach initiative that's sponsored by two stream programs, one in Rondout Neversink watershed and another one in the Ashokan watershed, with the grants from New York City Department of Environmental Protection. This whole thing started with my previous project called Yankeetown Pond Project, which was funded by ArtsMid Hudson. In this project, I proposed to set up a platform in what seemed to be a public parking spot by a pond that is nearby my house, which seemed to me was transforming from a pond to a swamp. And I wanted to create a very long-term time-lapse video with images that are submitted by visitors to that spot. And I did all of my homework, and I found out that spot belonged collectively to all the residents around the pond, and I contacted them, and there was like no problem. So I went ahead and set up the platform, but within several hours, it was flipped over and vandalized with a sign that said, "This is a private property, remove this eyesore." But this person left the contact information, so I went and knocked on his door and found out that he lived nearby, and he said that the people, all the residents along that road that he was living, also had a right to that spot in the pond, according to the old road agreement. And he totally protested that project. He said that he didn't want to attract any kind of attention. It was already getting a lot of visitors, and he didn't want it to look like a park, like a public park. So I didn't really want to fight that. It wasn't really about the legal rights. So I ended up making a totally different project out of that. And as a result, I interviewed all the residents around the pond. I got to know the history that I never knew. And I got to know this person as well, who turned out to be a caretaker of the pond. He would walk along the pond every day. He would clean out the ditch when it got clogged. He knew about the beavers and all kinds of creatures. And in the final documentary, I talked to him on camera, and we had a really good conversation. And since then, he and I have become friends. And, this attracted a lot of attention and got written up in Woodstock Times. And that, in turn, attracted attention of the stream programs, who wanted me to do something with their grants money, because they also deal with a lot of landowners. And their job is to restore and repair stream banks and to ensure the water quality of New York City water. So they wanted me to do a public outreach and educational program with their grants. So in Catskill Waters, I started with story collection. I wanted to get to know the residents of those watersheds. And then I wanted to bring in artists as facilitators of communication and connection building. So I matched the resident stories with three artists: Will Lytle, also known as Thorn Eater Comics, who is producing children's book based on the actual stream; Jenny Lee Fowler, who is known for her traditional silhouette portraits; and Chris Victor, an amazing visual artist. And they're all doing totally different projects. But so far, they've really exceeded my expectation.
So I'm sitting with Keiko Sono, and we're just talking about the Catskill Waters project. And I wanted to ask you, Keiko, if, just thinking about what it was like to actually begin a project like this, kind of going out, to meet strangers. I don't know why. Sometimes that scares me. I'm not somebody who's gone canvassing for any of the elections, because it intimidates me a little bit. So what did that look like? How did you actually start going out there and begin, integrating with the community?
So I had some experience with Yankeetown Pond Project. So I had gained some confidence in approaching strangers. When I first started promoting our events at the in Rondout Neversink Watershed, I thought that it was going to be pretty easy. I thought that people would just naturally love sharing their stories, which is true. So, I scheduled some dates for interviews, and I also said I would come to your place to interview you. And we did the email and snail mail, and I think maybe even like some radio promotion, but there was nothing. So this watershed, I had really not, I was not familiar with this area at all, even though it's only like half an hour away, and I had been hiking there before. So I was like, well, how different can it be from the Ashokan watershed that I live in? So it took me a year, really, to really get to know this community. This is a pretty sparsely populated area, with most people are older, and they've lived there for generations. They just weren't responding to my calls. So I had to first get to know just a few people who were influencers in that community. And one of them happened to be Carol Smythe, who is the town historian of Grahamsville. And she was a huge help. But even with her call, even with her help, I still wasn't really getting that great response. So that's when Jenny came in. We decided to host events called Portraits and Stories, where she would cut out portraits first, and then I follow with interviews. And this really worked wonders. I think there are a few reasons. I mean, number one, Jenny is just such a wonderful person that she, you know, helped people relax. But also the tradition of silhouette portraits, I think that connects with people with history, sense of history. And also by then, I had been there many times, so that at least people knew my face. So I think these few things really helped. And once they opened up, it was really quite wonderful. I ended up going back to the same place and the same people a few times because some of the people that I interviewed had amazing stories to share. Like one is the Muthig maple syrup farm. This is a multi-generational farm near Neversink. And these people are really interesting, great storytellers. They're very animated and they have great memories, and you know, they just really incorporate the history both of the area and obviously the history of the reservoir construction, their personal history, and also history of climate. You know, like Hurricane Irene comes up again and again and again. So yeah, it just took a long time, but it was really rewarding when that happened.
And am I remembering correctly, did you just have sort of a little reception?
Yes, I just did. Yeah, that was last Saturday. And it was really moving because almost all the people that we interviewed came out. And, you know, they don't really go out that much, you know, because a lot of them are old. And some of them, you know, doesn't really lack that mobility. But they were all there. At the Neversink General Store, which is also a really interesting hub for the community. And the chef of the general store created this amazing spread of food. So, it was pretty touching to see everyone at the same place, in one place.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any of them, I don't know, it might be hard for you to answer this question, but do you think that this changed their life or their, you know, just their attitude about the water in any way? You know, was this a part of the story, or was it just focusing on them to try to begin to build relationships?
I don't know if it changed their attitude towards water. They all have pretty strong opinion about land management. I would hope to think that they came to appreciate the stream program because they funded my program. But I think the biggest thing is just really this sense of kind of expanded community. Like I said, they openly said to me in the beginning that, you know, like, why are they giving you the money? Why are you doing this? Why are they giving artists outside of our community money to do this? So, when we finally gathered for the reception, that was obviously not in their mind. You know, they were very, very, I think, happy that we were there and we did this project. So I don't know. I'm not sure if this is going to, you know, translate into something really concrete. But I think this expanded feeling of like family or tribe or community, I think that is something I hope to see in other parts of our society.
It's really interesting that you bring it up, because I was just thinking of it the other day, how there's like some real beauty in thinking of your community. You know, like Radio Kingston is like a very Kingston-centric thing, supporting Kingston, which is beautiful and amazing. But who do you exclude when you do that? And does it create a boundary there that maybe doesn't need to be there, you know? And I don't know what the answer is. I think it probably has to do with intentions, but I can understand, you know, like there have been festivals in this area where people have criticized that we would bring artists from out of the area in to make art here. And I understand some of the principle why, you know, because it's like we want to support the people who are here. If there's financial reward in some way, I understand that impetus to take care of your own. But it's like who says it's your own? Like who says this is the only community that you have? So it's interesting that you kind of experience that. I don't know. I think it's just through living and doing what you did to help just maybe expand what their thoughts are about that.
So to go back to permaculture principle, one of the things that we always say is that problem is a solution. And I totally understand what you just said about even having a program like what you're doing. If you keep interviewing people of the like-minded, you know, thinkers and members of the community, yeah, sure, you might be reinforcing that wall. But, and if you do bring in outside people to do something within the community, you might, feel the animosity. But if you do overcome that, it's even more rewarding because you're expanding the community and you're breaking down that wall. But I think the risk is probably higher when you do that. So I think it's good to have a ambitious goal, but you need to back it up with a commitment that is needed to achieve that goal. And so maybe this is a good time to introduce Sundown, this other project.
Yep, exactly.
So the other project that we're doing in Catskill Waters is called Sundown. And this is a project where I matched artist Chris Victor with the owner of Three Goldens, which is the only guns and convenience store in Ulster County. I mean, I think, they're in Ulster County still. And his name is Paul Natu. And he's an avid Trump supporter and Second Amendment advocate. And as Chris and I were driving around the area to look for a location for his site-specific installation, we came across this little store on Peekamoose Road near Blue Hole in Sundown. I had driven that road so many times and I had seen that structure and I always wondered, is this place ever open? And there's this sign that said, convenience store, by appointment only, guns and ammo. So I'm like, okay. and then there's a payphone and two vending machines, really, really old Coke machines. And when Chris saw that, he said, this is the place. I want my sculpture right in between that payphone and those Coke machines. So we got out and the payphone worked. And so I said, okay. And I jot down the number and I called this person. And luckily, by this time, I had gotten to know a lot of members of Sundown. Sundown is a tiny, tiny little place. And people had told me about Paul. So I wasn't just really coming in from the cold. And so on the phone, he agreed to just meet with us, at least. And we had our first meeting in his store, which was really interesting. And again, he's an amazing storyteller. He was born in New York and he grew up in South Bronx. Or he grew up in East Village, but he went to school in South Bronx. And he talks all about that in our first meeting. And that's actually the first episode of our podcast, Sundown. And in it, he talks about how contentious the time was in the 70s when he was growing up. That's why he moved up here. And in operating this store, he had a few near shootouts, and he was talking about a situation where he kind of thought about shooting somebody, you know, and he talks about that in this podcast. And Chris just goes on and says, well, you know, this is why I do art. I'm really turned on by using materials like concrete and plastic. And I'm like, okay, this is really interesting. And, you know, they're like talking. And then they really hit it off because they're both makers. You know, Paul keeps repairing this old Coke machine. And he talks about that. And Chris is like, oh, yeah, you know, I watch YouTube video and I do my, you know, appliance repairs. So they decided to do it together. And I don't even know if Paul had any idea what the final result was going to look like. But I think, you know, he was really, you know, hoping to get more exposure and so that he would get more business, you know, for his store, and which I wanted to, too. So, you know, I was totally fine with that. So they recorded every conversation since then, which is all going to be on our podcast. And he finished it. He finished his installation. And so the final sculpture is a wall, of all things, a wall that is the height of the water that came up to the store during Hurricane Irene. So, you know, that area was really hit hard. And his store almost got destroyed in Hurricane Irene, but it was the Coke machine that saved it. And if you listen to our podcast, you understand how it was, how that happened. And the hurricane brought a whole bunch of sand and deposited it right around his store, which he bulldozed over. So there's this huge mound of sand. So Chris used that sand to stuff children's clothes and socks to create this wall. So when he told me about that idea, I was like, oh my gosh, that just sounds so loaded. I don't know if this is going to work. You know, I don't know what Paul's going to say, but we had a reception 2 weeks ago, and we had friends come over from Rosendale and High Falls, and there were local residents of Sandow, and it was great.
That's amazing. Do you anticipate, how long will the sculpture be up?
It'll be there until the Labor Day weekend, and I think he's going to take it down at that time. And I have to say that it's gone pretty well because we didn't really talk about politics. I understand that when Chris was installing it, you know, Paul would say something about Trump and he would like joke, oh, I'm going to put the MAGA hats on these sculptures. You know, he was like joking. And there was a time when Chris actually said to me on the phone, he said, I don't know about this. You know, I'm feeling a little weird. I feel a little dirty, you know, and I totally understood that because I've been in that situation too. I interviewed some, you know, residents who were avid Trump supporters. And, you know, just the fact that you're like laughing and joking with them, it made me feel, you know, is this the right thing to do? Because we're like skirting around. We're not talking about politics. We're just, you know, talking about whatever. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. So I'm still going to go back and do just a few more recordings with Paul, just me and Paul, and say at this point. So if there's any merit to doing this project, it's this. I feel now more confident to really go back to Paul and really actually ask him. So I don't know if I'll ask it like flat out like this, but you know, why do you support Trump? Or, you know, where are you coming from? Where do you think we're going to go? I would have never been comfortable to ask those kind of questions before, but I think I am now. So, you know, by doing this project, if I gained that kind of confidence, then I would say it was a success.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's interesting. I've been thinking of having those skills myself because it can be difficult for me to have those uncomfortable conversations. And I'm just thinking, I'm sort of just really thinking out loud right now, based upon your story And, you know, in any situation, and it actually kind of aligns with the other guest within today's show, who is a, she does mediation. And so it is this idea of any time two kind of opposing views or positions are coming together, very rarely is it, should it be that one side wins the other. There should be a compromise, right? There's that old saying, like, if everyone's unhappy, then you know it was like a good deal. And so I have to always remind myself that, which I'm not good at, that I can't always think my way is right. And I think like what you're describing, the experience of kind of having your walls come down and just be laughing with other humans. But then the mind goes, oh, no, you know, they have different opinions of mine that I can't support, you know, like I can't get behind them and I can't let them think that I agree with that. It's a very complicated mixed experience for the body, because like the heart is different than the brain. And I tend to think, just from like my principles and my intuition, that it's always best to go with the heart, even if that means I don't win my argument or whatever, you know. Or does that make any sense?
Yes. So, you know, when we're discussing politics, we tend to argue as to who is right and who is wrong. And this almost never really ends well, because it's not really about reasons or facts. You know, humans act really in contradiction to what is right, or what is even like against your own interest, because of, you know, tribalism, or, you know, really deep innate urges that are there for reason, you know, for evolutionary you know, development. So that's where I think art and artists can come in, because art is in the realm where reasons and facts kind of subside to the side, and you know, you tap into this emotional intelligence that we have, which is equally important as our, you know, cognitive intelligence. And that's where, you know, we can be in a space where we can suspend ourselves in this profound emotional state, where that, whether that be sadness or joy or love. And I think it's being in that state that's what's really needed, because once you're in that state, then you begin to look for solution where, you know, that state can be sustained.
This, like, this stuff is the, it's like the, to me, it's the answer, you know? And we have to figure out a way how to execute on it, you know? Otherwise, we're just going to keep fighting. It's going to be one side wins, another side wins, and the other side wins again, back and forth and back and forth. We need to talk about not politics, but well, I should say we're going to talk about a political issue. It's not really, it doesn't have to be a political issue. It's just an issue. And I'll just give the caveat that, you know, as a radio station, we don't support any particular candidate, but we can talk about issues on people's platforms. And I know the one thing that is very important to you is this position, this platform issue of universal basic income. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why you are supporting it.
Absolutely. So as I started being more involved with the artist community here, I noticed that there was such an abundance of creativity, yet there was such a scarcity of the means that would really support such activities, which is money. And the problem is that the economy system that we function in right now really doesn't nurture the kind of work habits natural way that our artists work, we can't convert our effort into hourly wages. We can't convert our output into, you know, like stocks and, you know, monetary values. And as soon as you put a price tag on our work, somehow it diminishes the value of work. So this is like so counterproductive. That's when I started to search for an alternative business model. And there's a book called The Gift by Lewis Hyde, which was really influential to me. And he talks about gift economy, where the economy is really not this about this linear growth or accumulation of wealth, but it's about the velocity or flow. You contribute into the flow, and as the flow that that flows into the community becomes more and more robust, the entire community is lifted and become rich. But as soon as somebody stops the flow and hoards it, then that kills the entire community, and it really diminishes the vitality of the entire people. So that's when I started to study universal basic income, because I felt that artists just needed to have a basic security so that we don't have to worry about bills. We don't have to worry about putting bread on the table. And once you do that, then you can search the kind of work that that really contributes to the abundance, you know, the kind of work that really enriches you as a person and the community. A lot of times people who are engaged in volunteer work, including creative work, they're so generous, but there comes a time when you just feel like, why am I doing this? Am I just a, you know, am I a sucker? Am I a loser? Why am I doing this without money? You know, it just makes you feel like you're a loser. This kind of psychological demoralization is as harmful as actual lack of money. So, you know, this is just such a loss for the whole society. You know, we're missing out on this incredible potential of creative output. So universal basic income, most people agree that it's a system where every citizen is given $1,000 a month, no questions asked. So the reason why this is important is because the existing welfare safety net that we have right now is means tested, means that if you make more than a certain amount of money, you lose the benefit. So that this incentivizes work, and it keeps you trapped in poverty. And also you have to jump through hoops to get a lot of, these programs like a SNAP and, you know, other assistance. So universal basic income gets rid of all of that. And it's universal, so there is no stigma attached. You know, it would really benefit a lot of people, but especially creative artists and makers.
It makes me, well, so I'm thinking, I know that there's a ton of resistance to this from a lot of people. And I wonder if it's just because of the way that it's, what it's called or how it's potentially going to operate. But I think if we could at least all come to the agreement that something is wrong, right? There's something unequal, unjust in the way that the world is operating right now financially. There have been a lot of articles that I've been reading recently about, you know, the amount of money that the wealthy keep accumulating and the lower 50% are getting poorer and poorer. We talk about even what the poverty rate is, the poverty level is a ridiculous number. I mean, it's nobody can live really off of $12,000 a year. I don't understand how that's even possible. And so I think like for smart people to come together and really just agree that we have a problem And we've got to figure out what the solution is. And I think universal basic income is being presented as an option. And unless somebody else comes up with another option, then that's the one that we should all be agreed to try. That's the way I look at it.
Well, universal basic income is not mutually exclusive with other proposals that are being put forth by other candidates right now. I support Andrew Yang because of his support for universal basic income, but also because he sees UBI as the first step in our way to transform the entire system that would put human our well-being as the priority as opposed to the accumulation of wealth. So this is it's in this line that I really support Andrew Yang. And people think that UBI is a really crazy idea, but it's actually being proposed by so many people, including Milton Friedman, Martin Luther King, Nixon, and even Hillary Clinton considered including that in her platform in 2016. And her reason was that she thought that it would give Americans a sense of unity. And I really agree with that. In Andrew Yang's words, he says that UBI means that America loves you. So UBI on its own is not going to fix everything, but it's an indispensable first step in my mind towards a larger transformation that is needed.
And I just thought about how, those ideas of community, if we can get to that mindset that we are all sharing the space together, we are one big community, maybe we can start to take care of one another.
I agree. An interesting thing that happens when you talk about UBI is that a lot of people say, oh, that's going to make other people lazy. And I say, well, would you stop working if you get $1,000 a month? Nobody says yes.
Right.
Nobody says yes. It's like, well, no, I would do this and this and that. Well, so why do you assume that other people would stop doing that kind of thing? So I think maybe we're stuck in that mindset of scarcity, because if you are well off, then that means other people would go down. What if, if you win, I win, and everybody wins?
Yeah. I love that. I want to thank you, Keiko, for all that you're doing. It really is such an honor to get to know you, and I appreciate you making time for this. I look forward to staying in touch with you and watching all of your future projects evolve. And thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're doing a little outro session here because I wanted to ask Keiko the question I always ask every guest, well, not always, but pretty much, is how do you take care of yourself?
So this is important. I try to eat well and I try to get exercise, but sometimes, I tend to neglect it. But surprisingly, I'm not that stressed. I'm actually pretty happy most of the time, even though, I'm getting like 5 hours of sleep and I'm under a crazy schedule. But I just read an article in Psychology Today that said that compassion reduces stress. So when I read that, it's like, oh, that's why I'm not stressed, because, my work is my self-care. So that mystery solved there. But I have to say that my biggest challenge right now is that I'm not taking care of two most important people in my life. One is my mother, Toko Sono, and my another one is my husband, Martin Knowles, who is a therapist here in Kingston. These two people are my biggest supporters in my life. And unfortunately, they're the ones who are not receiving love, appreciation, care from me. This is my biggest challenge and regret. So if you're listening, Mom and Martin, I love you and I appreciate you.
That was beautiful. I'm glad we got to capture that.
Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you, Keiko. So I'm sitting here with Claudia Abbott Barish, who is the Restorative Justice Coordinator at the Mediation Center of Dutchess County. And I've heard of Claudia through several loving friends, mutual friends, but this is my first chance of actually getting to meet you, Claudia, so I'm really grateful for this. And I had heard Claudia speak. There was a movie screened at Upstate Films called Circle Up, right? That was the name of the film. Mm-hmm. And it was essentially about the restorative justice process, the circle process, focusing on two mothers who had lost their sons to homicides. And it was really their journey about their own healing process. At least that's the way I interpreted it. And the work that they're doing to try to help others who are in similarly situated places. And it was a really beautiful film. Claudia did some speaking, and I thought, I really need to get this woman on the radio show. And so here we are. Lucky me. So, Claudia, I'm going to start out by asking you to describe in your own words what it is you do. We'll start there, and then we'll get into the why of it.
Okay. So I coordinate the Restorative Justice Initiative at the Mediation Center of Dutchess County, and that was relaunched in early 2017. And, it's gone through various stages in its emergence and growth. And right now we work a lot with youth serving organizations and schools to promote kind of alternatives or supplementary disciplinary practices to more punitive, retributive practices. And, you know, ones that focus on building relationship, building understanding, and ones that focus, you know, in huge part on building relationships as a preventative measure. So building opportunities for students to connect, to create a sense of belonging, to inform the kind of narratives that govern the classroom, the school culture, and not just students, but teachers as well, administrators, kind of looking at schools as a culture and a community and how to create an equitable community where students feel seen and heard and feel protective of that community. And so are that much more likely to engage in responsive practices if conflicts do arise in a way that they are reflecting on their behavior, their actions, their impact, and have support systems in place that help them do that work. And the premise being that we are more likely to reflect on our actions and our behavior when those challenging that behavior are in relationship with us, as opposed to kind of arbitrary other parties that are kind of coming down on us from above.
Like an authority figure that comes in to punish. Mm-hmm. Or I'm feeling like the natural instinct is to kind of retract and close up. Mm-hmm. And then there's no opening for anything there.
Yeah. I mean, the way kind of punitive practices operate really promote defensiveness, promote isolation, promote sort of a movement away from your actions. I mean, I could get really deep into the philosophy, which I'll try not to do right now. But,
well,
yeah.
It makes me think about talking a little bit sort of philosophically about restorative justice. I had a woman on the show in the past who has been trained in restorative justice, and she comes at it from more of the legal perspective. And I know that restorative justice is oftentimes talked about it from a criminal justice perspective, but obviously it is multifaceted. I mean, it has many uses. And so maybe just diving in a little bit about the principles behind restorative justice. Mm-hmm. And the use case, the applications that you've seen it used with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's a good moment also to make a distinction between restorative practices and restorative justice. And I think, like you said, largely people's understanding of restorativeness is in the justice framework as an alternative to incarceration, detention, kind of more, like I said, retributive practices within the criminal justice system. And then there's also this school of restorative practices, which has been kind of largely popularized by the International Institute for Restorative Practices, which is a certificate and graduate institution in Pennsylvania that really wanted to figure out how to make restorative philosophy systemic and how to create institutions that are restorative, and looking at this, what they call kind of the 80%, 20% split. So to make a culture systemically restorative, focusing 80% of your time on building relationship and equity within the system as a proactive measure. So, for example, holding community building circles as a regular practice, whether as a way to start the week or a way to carry out all of your classes, with this, which has the structure that every person has an opportunity to speak, an equal opportunity to speak. The conversation is regulated by a talking piece, and the keeper, the circle keeper, is there to ask sort of questions that build on each other, that build on a thought process that engages people both mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically, so that people feel like their whole selves are present in the circle. And that comes from the indigenous origins of restorative practices, of circle practices that identify that, you know, your whole health and well-being needs to be secure in order to engage in conversation, engage in connection with others, to build relationships. And then the 20% is this responsive practice, whether it's a circle, a conflict circle, or a restorative conference, which is in response to a significant incident of harm, a crime, what have you, that brings together anyone who's been directly impacted, indirectly impacted, and then their support systems in an effort to create a common understanding, sort of a collective narrative about what happened, you know, how did it happen, who was impacted, and then what everyone in the circle needs in order to move forward, which again goes back to this idea that we're all connected, that my well-being relies on your well-being, relies on the well-being of the whole, and vice versa, that the whole can't be healthy without the well-being of the individuals that make up that community or group.
I don't want to take us on a crazy tangent, but I'm just realizing how in today's modern society, we are so far away from that because of technology, largely. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of getting together in community. I mean, I shouldn't say that. Of course there is, right? There's a lot of things that people are doing with one another, but there isn't this sort of conscious appreciation of the fact that we are sharing this world, our space together, our community together. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit, because you do work with a lot of youth. I mean, you had some of the youth at the film that was screened, and they were leading circles. I actually had to go and I didn't get to participate. I was really sad. But I'm wondering what you are seeing in the responsiveness of the youth to this, because it's obviously it's a lost tradition for many people, or we've just imposed a Western tradition on things. But what are you seeing in the receptiveness and the responses from the youth that you work with?
Yeah, I mean, it varies. There's a spectrum of experiences, of responses. But I would say by and large, I actually have an intern going through all of my surveys, kind of trying to figure out, you know, what are the themes that are emerging. And for the most part, students really appreciate an opportunity to be heard. And more than anything, what they like about it is feeling connected to other students in a way that they wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity to feel. It's quite simple. And I'm bummed that you weren't part of the circle, just because the students did such a good job. I mean, students who've been in one or two circles, facilitated circles, and are just such soulful humans that just sort of naturally are able to facilitate. And There's definitely also some discomfort. You know, it's really hard to listen, to not push back, even in sort of a good-natured kind of way. You know, I give various speeches at the beginning of the first circle I do with a group that just have to do with this as a skill. Listening is a skill. And there was a quote from someone who was at a training recently who said, you know, you have two ears and one mouth for a reason. Like, we should be doing more listening than speaking.
Wow, that's deep. Yeah, I like that.
I really like that. And we don't practice a whole lot, or at least we practice kind of under duress, like in a classroom where we have to listen whether or not we like it, whether or not someone's checked in with us about whether or not we can listen today. And so there's definitely discomfort with waiting, with silence in between answers. And I definitely come from the place of kind of leaning into the uncomfortable places, because those are the places you need to grow. And so I try to communicate that in my work with youth about getting comfortable with silence and getting comfortable with waiting and giving yourself the extra moment to reflect or hear what someone's saying.
What a fabulous experience. If imagining a world, you know, I don't know, 100 years from now, where everyone can be more cognizant of how to just relate to other people. Mm. And maybe you can talk a little bit. You've talked about, and when we talked earlier, you mentioned, you know, I don't remember the exact quote, and I don't think I'm able to find it, but it was a lot of about relationships. And you talk about how being able to work through a conflict using, is if there's somebody who you can relate to facilitating it, rather than this authoritative, you know, person coming in to kind of regulate things. Is there a way to kind of unpack that a little bit? I don't know if I've ever actually used that phrase, unpack. Everyone says it. I just said it. But can you maybe just break that down a little bit about the importance of relationship?
Sure. I can actually break it down a lot.
Okay, cool.
I might get a little academic with it. But there's actually, so one of the kind of cornerstones of IRP, I'm not intentionally like plugging them, but they, you know, they have trained me in various things. But I do encourage sort of a wide breadth of inquiry into restorative practice, simply because there are so many practitioners with so many lenses. And they talk about, there's a Australian criminologist called Braithwaite who looked at, rather than why do people, you know, commit crime, or why do people do wrong things sometimes, he asked, why do people mostly do the right thing? And his answer was, for the fear of kind of compromising bonds, sort of bonds that connect human beings. And this goes, then, you know, you can take a deep dive into affect theory, which is all about, there are 9 biological impulses that all humans have, regardless of how we're socialized in our lives, that we're born with, that there's 7 negative or 6 negative affects, 1 neutral affect, and 2 positive affects. Unfortunately, there's only 2 positive affects. And they just describe these biological impulses that we have to stimulate in our environment. So examples being like joy, the feeling of joy, the feeling of disgust, the feeling of fear. And he actually uses baby faces. I have a slideshow of baby faces, because you can see on babies' faces just like these very common expressions that we can all identify that are true for all of us. And then associated with each affect is a physical or emotional impulse that we have, that we experience immediately after the biological impulse has been stimulated. And actually, shame is an affect. It evolved later on in our evolution as humans, and it was in kind of a in response to safety in our environment, and it's the experience of shame as a, just a very basic biological impulse is just the recognition that something is off, something's not right. It's actually what's referred to as the interruption of positive affect. So the story I have about it is that I think of, you know, when you're, well, this one's easier to relate to. The other one's a little esoteric, but when you're kind of bantering with a friend and, you know, everything's cool, you're sort of teasing each other a little, everything seems fine, it's good natured, it's good spirited, and then someone says something that maybe triggers the other person completely unbeknownst to you, and all of a sudden a line has crossed, the vibe completely shifts, and you have this feeling of like, oh no, what just happened? And that is a feeling of shame. That's just like a very common experience that you can't really get away from. And it's this feeling that then stimulates the need to reconnect, this kind of like, I need to fix whatever just happened, or I feel really far away from this person. How can I repair this bond that's just been broken in some sort of way? And so reconnection is that emotional impulse that accompanies shame. But we live in a very stigmatizing society. And so shame has been completely corrupted to, you know, weaponized as a form, sort of a reason to isolate, to stigmatize, to push someone away. It's how we deal with, you know, it's how the criminal justice system works. It's how suspension and expulsion work in school systems. And it's even like how we call people out that we don't agree with is this sort of shaming process. But in traditional societies, indigenous societies, shame was treated in as a reintegrating format. So as this opportunity to acknowledge there's this potent moment where actually the impulse to reconnect is huge. And if we can use that moment as a way to teach someone about the impact of their actions while also letting them know how important they are and how valuable they are to the health of the society, to the community as a whole, that is going to sit with them far longer than if they were pushed out, they were told that they were bad. They then start to connect with other people who have that same feeling and identity. We can do so much more learning and teaching and connecting and create intimacy if we use it as a tool for reconnection as opposed to isolation.
Well, and I really like that you shared that, because I feel like it is something that we all can absolutely relate to on both ends, on both ends of it, right? We've probably been shamed and we've shamed other people. And so if we can understand that shame is an important thing to experience and that there's a healing process that can follow, maybe we can actually just, you know, modify our own behavior and or heal from experiences a bit better.
Yeah. And I think also sort of in addition to that, I think of, you know, kind of the flip side of that being like how, I don't know if it's like current society, helicopter parenting and what have you, this like desire to shield our kids from everything and ever experiencing anything uncomfortable. But like I said, you know, at least for me anyway, I think it's so important to feel uncomfortable and reflect on why you feel uncomfortable and try and figure out how to learn from it. And I just feel like I'm concerned for the parents that are shielding their kids from experiences that will teach them about how to be in the world.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do a whole show on that one. Okay, Claudia, so I know that you've had a very extensive... You have a very extensive background and training in a lot of social activism work in various areas, environment, race,
health.
Yeah, lots. You've done lots. And then you made a switch in a way into this, the work that you're doing now. And I wonder if you can just give a little background of that and why you decided to make the change. Just a little.
Yeah.
Just a little question.
I mean, I think there were a number of things happening kind of, you know, swirling around. I don't kind of make swift changes all of a sudden. There's usually a huge rumination period. And, you know, I was organizing in the Hudson Valley and at the same time was sort of exploring restorative justice and mediation. And that had really come, I would say, maybe most explicitly from having just come out of grad school and having done a degree in anthropology of sustainable development and kind of looking at, like, what even is development and what even is sustainability if not everyone is coming to the table, if, you know, power imbalances dictate who is informing ideas and discourses around sustainability, even around development and whether or not that's even a viable thing to be exporting to the whole world. I mean, that's a whole other conversation.
We'll do another show on that one.
There's a lot of shows. And having come from, like, a very strong organizing background before going to grad school and having, like, a very polarized view about right and wrong and justice and injustice, and which I think is in a lot of ways necessary in organizing in order to, like, galvanize a base, galvanize passion and motivation, and to gather around something specific and tangible, I really kind of, in a good way, was made to reflect on that in grad school about, well, these ideas that it's one versus the other, as opposed to all these myriad ways that contextually things change and power is exercised in different ways in different contexts and blah, blah, blah. I just, like, got more curious about that complexity and highlighting many voices as opposed to these two sort of polarized voices. And that, in combination with the fact that, you know, while doing anti-oppression work, anti-oppression organizing, there were still, you know, some instances of sort of interpersonal oppression within groups that I was organizing with, you know, that we talk about in anti-oppression organizing, just like the circles of oppression, and from, like, a structural down to an interpersonal and even to an internalized personal level, that it exists everywhere. And I was really curious about how we do it between each other, between kind of neighbors, between people on the street, between partners within families, and also at the same time, I was really thinking about, you know, I am a person trying to leverage my privilege to support the voices of others, and yet I'm still centering my voice as a voice for people. And I just got more and more solid with this idea that I wanted to use my capacity to support actual voices that were lesser heard or lesser valued in society. And I love that I do that with young people, because I feel like they're huge source of untapped voice that I want to support being empowered in our society, and then just largely creating systems that are more equitable and representative through people having access to tell their stories and to have those stories legitimized, and then through that storytelling create new pathways, possibilities that are just so much richer and dynamic, and not because some white lady said so, but because there's this sort of group of different voices coming together to create something.
I didn't ask you this before, but I'm going to ask you it because it just kind of came up. And thinking, you know, when you do work like organizing, or when you're involved in any group and you step away from it, sometimes it can feel scary, can feel like you've left a vacuum there. And I wonder if it was difficult at all, you know, if you feel loss of connections, you know, at all. What did that look like?
Yeah, there's definitely an element of loneliness that I felt at first, and then from time to time, because, yeah, it is such a community. And, you know, I'd been largely organizing in Hudson, and then my job is primarily in Poughkeepsie. And so I was, you know, shifted in a different, like, geographical direction as well. And so many of the relationships I had cultivated, I wasn't regularly engaging with. And And then there's a certain loneliness just about being the person who, you know, this is work that I 100% believe I'm called to do. You know, I feel at the Mediation Center, you know, our view of conflict is a crisis in communication, and restorative philosophy looks at as conflict as an opportunity to deepen understanding and to normalize it. You know, conflict is normal. It's going to be around forever. And it's actually, you know, like we talked about in terms of shame and reconnection, it provides this pivotal moment to create intimacy. And I am, you know, I'm not a good small talker at parties. Like, intimacy is my jam. And so, especially sometimes, like, on the front lines of activism, there isn't that same kind of, and I'm not saying like across the board, and this is only my experience, but there can be fear of a certain level of intimacy and vulnerability and, you know, this element of like always being on your game and always being woke enough and always, you know, having to be polished. And I appreciate the messiness and the vulnerability and the kind of connecting through that with curiosity. And so in some ways I've always been a little lonely because I want to be in those intimate spaces, but I also feel in some ways that the way I'm building my own personal relationships look different because they, on like a really human level, revolve around, do I feel good and comfortable in company with you, as opposed to like, what can we achieve together in this sort of like more productionist, like, what change are we going to make? And obviously I'm not saying change isn't important. That's all that's important in my mind. But where do I feel loved and seen and safe and not judged? And where can I be still growing, not perfect, you know, still interrogating everything, because I will always be doing that, but where, you know, where can I get respite and where can I get comfort?
You create an image for me, and I'm not saying that you did this intentionally, but I'm thinking, I'm seeing people really who are fighting for their cause, and you are fighting against somebody. And this isn't to say that those things aren't necessary. I mean, I went to law school because of the civil rights movement. I was enamored with the power to overcome a lot of injustice. And so you have to do that in certain situations. And I don't know how you find that balance, right? Where if there is always a compromise to be had, or what that looks like. But I'm just thinking about how when you are in that position, it behooves you to not become personal with your opponent, because as soon as you do, it becomes so much harder to fight against them. And if I look at the whole, you know, what we're seeing around us with the polarization politically, racially, religions, you know, all of these different entities that are oftentimes, not always, but, you know, fighting against the other person, I wanna understand how we stop the fighting. How can we do that, Claudia? So yeah, I mean, do you think, I don't know if there are things that, I guess it comes back to this question where that I kind of asked you earlier about, what do you do if the other person doesn't want to engage in the conversation and you're the one who wants to do it? And I kind of make those assumptions, you know, with politics or race, that it's always that, you know, the two sides don't actually want to talk to one another. So what do you do if that is the situation? Is there anything we can do?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's all voluntary. And I think we were talking about this before off air, just about, we can't make assumptions about why they're unwilling. You know, we all represent the experiences we've had, the traumas we've faced, and that can drastically inform whether or not we're prepared to sit down and have a conversation. And I think it can also be have a different conversation. So I remember after Trump was elected, I was just like, I want to start hosting like dinner talks at the town hall and like get everyone, you know, people who supported different people, like just get them together and talking. But obviously I wouldn't, you know, the topic wouldn't be why'd you vote for Trump or why didn't you? It would be like, what's important to you? Like what makes you happy? And provide opportunities for connection on a human level without jumping into the hard stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's so hard about the format of, and again, like I really am not, I'm not saying like I love activism, yeah. like I am a proponent of it. And I think the format is difficult to galvanize a movement around that represents people with drastically different perspectives, because we're trying to talk about really difficult things without any ceremony around it, you know, without any toe dipping. It's like we're going, like jumping right into the heart of the most difficult conversations. And, you know, as an activist, like we're prepared for those conversations because it's all we ever think about. It's all, you know, all we're digesting. It's the lens through which we look at everything. And for people who that's not the case, they are ill prepared for that conversation. And so thinking about the type of conversations they are prepared for and starting there and moving into the more difficult things is actually the restorative approach. You know, when it's something I teach in my trainings is how to structure a circle. You know, the circle is seen as a ceremony where you start with kind of checking in, connecting with people where they're at, developing values and guidelines, like how are we going to be in this space? How can we agree to be in this space together? And then you start with really basic questions that anyone can answer without reflecting too hard. And then, you know, there's an arc you go into. It's usually reflections on a past experience, so something they have intimate experience with. They can tell you, they probably already have a story about it, and then moving into, and so how does that inform who you are now and how you look at things? And then, you know, how might this inform how you would approach a similar situation in future? It's this very chronological kind of past, present, future. It takes you, you know, beginning, middle, end. It's a story. And so there's this, all this setup at the beginning where people are building trust and connecting with each other. And it's only after this sort of gentle reflection that you move into some bigger questions about how are you gonna sort of embody your values in the world, you know, like some bigger things about how to make some forward action, how to plan, and also how to do so informed by all the stories that you've heard in the circle. So really just thinking about the psychology of confronting new ideas, the psychology of conflict. It's really imperative to set up safety, to set up connection, to set up trust before you introduce challenging concepts, because like we said at the beginning, you're less likely to be open to those concepts if you feel defensive, you feel unsafe, you feel judged.
I wonder if you have any thoughts on this. I've often thought of, you know, this idea of winning. Right? We're kind of cultured from an early age, you know, through sports and other things to win. And that I think gets carried over into a lot of these deeper social issues. And I wonder if there's a different way that we can be rearing our children in those kinds of competitive situations. Mm. Have you ever thought about that?
Totally. I actually, when I was going over the questions in your email, winning is like where I got to when I was thinking about how to answer some of them. And the thing that I ended up thinking about most was something I participated in an Algonquin conflict resolution workshop held by Evan Pritchard, and he introduced this concept that I really love, that is harmony, not unity. And, you know, we think of, you know, I think of harmony as like, you know, different voices that on their own, you know, sound nice, but when they come together, they just introduce this richness and complexity and dynamism that they wouldn't have otherwise. And the notion is, you know, that we're not all supposed to be the same. You know, unity implies one way of doing something, one way of seeing, one way of believing, and harmony implies just like the beautiful complexity of different perspectives coming together and creating something new. And I do feel like, and I could go into sort of academic institutions in terms of like philosophies of how different ideas are refined and carried through and combat previous ideas and almost try to erase previous ideas, like try to kind of be the winner in every generation, like this new philosophy, this new way of looking at it, and let's like kind of silence what came before because it was wrong. And that's like, it's something that pervades so much of how we live our lives, is the idea that we're, you know, there is one, it's universalist theory, which is a very Western philosophy, is that there's one way, there's one place we're trying to get to, that everyone should aspire to get to, that, you know, in the same model. And I just like, I think it's a real sadness that we can't celebrate all the messiness that we've come from, the, you know, the mistakes that we made, and show how they inform our present and our growth and our complexity. And I think it's, you know, a huge part of why people don't admit they're wrong, or people aren't accountable, is that they don't want to admit that they didn't do it right. But admitting that you didn't do it right is the best way. You know, we have all these conflicting things that we say to our kids, like, well, you have to fall down in order to like get up again, and yet, you know, admitting that you're wrong is something that's really hard for us to do.
It goes back to shame, mm-hmm. right? It's internalized shame.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sitting with Claudia Abbott Barish from the Mediation Center of Dutchess County, and we've been having a lovely conversation. At least I've been enjoying it a lot. And one of the things that I last left us with is this idea of neutralizing power. It's something that Claudia said on the phone when we chatted about neutralizing power to create equality. And I guess talking about really how the restorative practices work is a way of neutralizing power, and why, I guess, why that feels like maybe activism to you. You know, what can you elaborate in your beautiful wording, why you feel that that's important?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, equity and representation to me are at the heart of this work and are at the heart of my own activism. And for me, how to make that possible is creating opportunities and structures where voices can be heard to whatever, to greater or lesser extent, they choose to be heard. And that's also taking into consideration the fact that our experiences of raising our voices vary. We were talking about this before as well, that, you know, our associations vary from person to person. For one person, raising their voice might be an empowered feeling. And for another person, their associations might be punishment. Like they raised their voice once or multiple times and were shut down multiple times. And so, you know, I feel like circle processes, which are sort of the dominant processes that I facilitate, create, you know, are focused not just on lifting voices, but how to create an environment where voices can be lifted and where they can be celebrated and where difference can be not just accepted or tolerated, but celebrated and, you know, recognized for the richness that they bring to any situation, any community, any group, any relationship, that actually having different perspectives, different worldviews, different experiences all contribute to much richer understanding of what it is to be a human, and that they are critically important in leading a healthy life. You know, this idea that our liberation, you know, the liberation of one person is connected to the liberation of others. And so, you know, even though I'm not in the sort of standard activist setting or what we think of when we think of activism kind of on the front line or what have you, my focus is on that sort of equity of voice and choice and being able to inform decision making for decisions that impact your life and more structurally, more institutionally, how to play an informed part of what the rules, what the policies, what the norms and paradigms are that govern an institution that you are spending a huge amount of your life and which is responsible for helping you become your, you know, your best, most intelligent, mm-hmm. most capable self.
Well, and it makes me think even outside of like the educational situation, just looking at the voices that are actually heard. I was driving over here listening to Terry Gross talk about the Koch brothers, right? And how much they control so much money. And in turn, they control a lot of political decisions. And it makes me think, like, where are the collective voices in this country? It is largely the voices that dominate a lot of the systems and structures are few. Mm-hmm. They're a select group of individuals, even though we have elected representatives. Oftentimes they are, I guess I can't make assumptions, but they're influenced by other voices that are louder and more powerful. Mm-hmm. And so I am fond of this idea of understanding power and I don't know if destabilizing power is the right thing. I get a little hung up on when is power important? And I guess it's that kind of fine line between, you know, a certain form of activism, like maybe a more traditional form of activism versus like your form of activism and the work that you do as a restorative practices. How do we look at power and how do we define power? And then how do we share the power with other people? I wonder if you've had any, I guess, if you are able to see or notice any changes in how you relate to others through your education and your work and your training in the restorative practices. Are you more aware of anything or have you shifted your behavior in any way? And I guess I ask both just to elucidate kind of your experience, but also maybe as a means of sharing how others may start to embody these kinds of philosophies in their own day-to-day life.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of catchphrases that I ring true for me, you know, kind of one, seek first to understand before being understood. You know, so much of our disorientation or fear or urgency around conflict is in the desire to be understood, and we often kind of, you know, blinder or sort of tune out what other people are saying until we feel understood, but appreciating that the other person's having the same experience, like a proactive measure that you can take is to take the moment to pause and be like, okay, I want to understand where you're coming from. Tell me how you see it. And then it's in that hearing of the story that you can usually identify the dissonance, identify the misunderstanding, the difference in perspective. And once you can identify just difference, which is such a, you know, will always be part of our human experience. Once you can identify the difference, there's so much power in that. Just saying, oh, okay, you see it this way and I see it this way. Can you understand why I might see it this way? Because I can understand why you might see it that way. That's one thing. And then sort of, I mentioned it already, just urgency, taking urgency out of the equation. That was a huge part of my own experiences with conflict in my family, was the level of urgency with which especially my sister and I used to confront conflict, because a huge part of our childhood trauma was around rejection and abandonment. And whenever we got into conflict, the fear of rejection and abandonment from each other was so huge that there was so much urgency in addressing whatever it was that had happened, but usually from a very antagonistic standpoint. And so we learned while I was studying this, how to take a moment to take that urgency out and to sort of be able to clear away, you know, how much of this was triggered from past experiences and how much of this is what's happening in the present. And so taking out urgency, I think, is just such a critical part. And I think in terms of my own, you know, your own relationship with yourself, it's such a critical part of your own self-care is take the urgency out, take the judgment out, like let yourself go through whatever process you need to go through and appreciate that there's an end in sight. And, you know, it won't be the end of the world no matter what it is.
It was such a joy having you here and getting to talk to you about these things. I think we have like three other shows that we need to do and subjects that we couldn't cover in one day. But I appreciate the work that you're doing and I appreciate you sharing it. I'm really hopeful that it will maybe help somebody else out there who's dealing with conflict. It might just create an opening to know that there might be another way of moving through it. So thanks, Claudia.
Thank you so much.
That's the show today, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed these conversations as much as I did. Today's show was engineered and beautifully put together by Manuel Bloss of Radio Kingston. You heard music by the fabulous Shana Falana. And until next week, love yourself and uplift one another.